Today, in the second day of the penalty phase in the trial of Zhihar Zanayev, the jury heard still more wrenching testimony from survivors of the 2013 Boston Marathon bombings and touching family memories of those who died at the hands of the Zanayev brothers. All of it builds on the government's case that Zanayev's crimes were heinous, cruel, and depraved, and thus warrant the death penalty. And in day 21, Zanayev's defense team entered video evidence on a curious subject, the middle finger that Zhihar flashed to a holding cell security camera shortly after he came into federal court for the first time. From the Moakley Federal Courthouse, this is Finish Line, inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial. I'm David Boeri for WBUR.
And I'm Kevin Cullen from the Boston Globe.
Kevin, the question, after today's testimony, I wonder, watching that jury that's now become a box of tears, seeing those jurors crying openly, how much more can they take?
Yeah, I think it's interesting when we look at the first phase of this trial, the guilt phase. It seems that the government was a little more concerned about the pacing in the sense we never got more than a few victims together. And if you recall, almost without fail, those victims did not cry. They were very matter-of-fact. They were very moving. But this stuff has a visceral feel to it, which is completely different. And it seems to me, I mean, just personally speaking, it takes more of an emotional toll.
Some of them are victims themselves who testify today. What I found particularly interesting are the family members of those who died.
Yes.
And what the prosecution has done here is to encourage the witnesses to bring out family stories so that the jurors get the sense of being at a family reunion
right. That
sort of morphs into a wake for the victims.
Where they're shown snapshots from family albums, literally from family albums, and they're invited to see themselves at that family and be there for a Thanksgiving dinner or be there for a wedding where everybody's posing. And everybody that's sitting on that jury, David, has been in a photograph like that, whether it was their kid's first communion, their kid's bar mitzvah, somebody's wedding, their grandmother's and their grandfather's 50th anniversary, they've all been in those pictures and say they empathize. They know exactly what that family feels like when it's together, and now they're being taught what it's like when that family is shattered.
Yeah. Joe Rogers, who's the stepfather of Sean Collier, who was shot to death by the Zanayev brothers a few days after the bombings, talks about Sean growing up, and he's telling jokes.
Yeah.
He talks about Sean getting in trouble. He talks about how the proudest moment in Sean's life was becoming a police officer and having his mother pin him at the ceremony. Then he talks about going to Foxborough and how
Patriots.
Sean says that he can't stand his sister because she never shuts up and he won't come back to the game if he has to come with her. And this is remarkable because amidst all this pain and this witnessing, bearing witness to so much violence, now the jurors are laughing,
yeah. They're
smiling, they're giggling. You can see them beaming at these family stories.
I thought it was striking that Joe described that blended family. He said, "We were the Brady Bunch."
Brady Bunch.
And I think almost everybody in that jury, except maybe the youngest ones, would have known exactly what he meant. And so he's describing, and we're all laughing along, it was like a sitcom. It was a happy blended family. And then suddenly, he cuts to that scene where the family is together. They're huddled in a room at Massachusetts General Hospital. And there's Sean lying there, dead. And he says there's a hole in the middle
of his
head.
And he was shot to pieces.
This went from sitcom to tragedy in a flash.
You were talking earlier about this idea of jurors being death qualified so they can sit on the jury at a death penalty trial. I'm thinking today, here you have the prosecution encouraging the families to talk so they can get the jurors to feel the full humanity of the victims in order to do what? In order to motivate the jury to come up
and
with a
him.
Death sentence to kill him.
Yeah.
It's a strange concept.
The government, what it wanted to show today is that Zanayev did not just kill Sean Collier. He did not just put the bomb down that killed Lingzi Liu. He killed a part of these families, that there was something missing from these families that would never allow them to be the families they were before.
And we go back to Joe Rogers, the stepfather. He's asked about the effect of what's happened. And then he tells a story that's truly stunning in its devastation of children who are totally depressed or others who can't talk about the subject.
One of Sean's sisters moved to Texas. She had to get away.
Because she couldn't hear the talk of it anymore. Yeah. Couldn't bear to hear the talk of it anymore. The wife.
Kelly,
who's depressed, who has post-traumatic stress disorder.
Joe said she was diagnosed with PTSD. She's a woman that, before this happened, managed 130 people in a medical facility and has not worked since. Joe Rogers said it took her 2 months just to get out of bed. She's doing better, and then last week was the second anniversary of Sean's murder. She couldn't get out of bed for 2 days. To me, one of the most effective things that the government did is, as terrible as that story was about the Collier family, they showed that it wasn't peculiar to our culture, the American culture, because they proceeded to explain what happened to Lingzi Liu, the Chinese graduate student at Boston University who was killed by the bomb that Jahars and I have left outside the Forum restaurant, and the devastation of her family. It's a different devastation, but no less horrible. These are parents who reluctantly but proudly let their daughter come to the United States to study. And Lingzi Liu's aunt, Helen, was up there explaining the significance of this, that in China there is a one-child policy. Lingzi was an only child by government fiat. And not only that, within that culture, it is incumbent, as Helen explained, that the child takes care of their parents when they go into older age. In Lingzi's case, her grandparents lived in her house. There were three generations in that house. And so imagine that. Lingzi's parents allow her to come to America and are proud of her beyond their dreams that she's here studying at a prestigious university. And then she doesn't come home.
And under careful questioning from the prosecution, because they're trying to get the jury to determine and to decide that Jahar Zanayev is not worth keeping alive, that he deserves death. They bring out the information from Helen Zhou that when Lindsay's mother comes, it, and I'm quoting here, it just felt like she was part of Boston, namely Lingzi Liu, part of the city, that she should stay here. So they decide to bury her, and they bury her in a pink bridal gown with a tiara.
The one that her mother imagined she would have worn on her wedding day.
And so I'm trembling as I'm telling you this, because there's even more pathos in this. They show a video at Boston University for the memorial service back in 2013, in which her father, who came for that memorial service, reads a poem that was written to comfort the Liu family by a nearby village, I believe. And here's what it reads. The voice of Lingzi Liu: "Dear Dad and Mom, don't cry. I love you. If there is an afterlife, I will be your daughter again. May the perished rest in peace and the survivors be strong."
Oof. Oof.
Suddenly, in the midst of the testimony today, the defense comes alive. They rise for the first time to make a cross-examination. And so you recall, we both recall, the opening statement on Tuesday, the prosecution showed an image of Zanayev with his middle finger thrust before the surveillance camera and the whole
thing. It was their coda. It was very dramatic.
Very dramatic. July 10th, 2013. He's being arraigned. He's making his first appearance in this courthouse, and he's in the holding cell. And the prosecution uses that image to great effect. We talked about it yesterday. David Pellegrini says, as that image is there, "This is Jahar Zanayev, unconcerned, unrepentant, and unchanged. Without remorse, he remains untouched by the grief and the loss that he caused. He remains the unrepentant killer he is." Suddenly today, because the defense gets up and cross-examines, we get a different view of that image, so to speak. So they enter into evidence the actual video from which that image came and was frozen. And to me, it puts that middle finger in far less sinister light. We see him enter the cell, then he walks toward the camera, which is covered by a reflecting surface, and he appears to treat it as a mirror. I timed it. It's less than 8 seconds. He touches his hair. He flashes a victory or a peace sign, or he makes a V shape. Then, in the quickest of gestures, he sticks up his middle finger. It's frozen in time as a single image by the prosecution, this flipping his middle finger, and it becomes a front page story. I covered it. You covered it. What do you think now that you've seen the video?
I think that Miriam Conrad was successful in putting this in a different context. and stealing sort of the way that the prosecution framed it. But I must say, as I sat there, it didn't change my view. This is somebody who was about to be arraigned on the most serious of charges you can imagine for causing the murders of four people, and that he was in there fixing his hair. There's no doubt in my mind, when you look at the proper context, the whole video, he was using that as a mirror. He was not using it as a mirror when he flashed the middle finger. He knew that somebody was on the other side of that camera. I still think that was a very defiant gesture by him. Now, we could debate. The jury is going to have to make the decision. But the way I looked at it is that the defense was successful in rowing back it a little, but just only in the context of it. If I'm a juror sitting that, that there's a kid who just caused incredible damage and he's flipping people off.
Yeah, to me, there's considerably less there than meets the eye. To me, it's such a split-second thing. It suggests he's flipping his own self off.
I think that's what Miriam wanted people to think. I didn't think that.
But what bothers me more, I think, is they got a case against him that's 3 miles deep. And I worry about the prejudicial effect of that frozen image. And the prosecution, I think they gave us a little false advertising. I would have been more appreciative, I think, had they shown it in its video form.
When they were retired for their deliberations, they will, in fact, have that video with them because the defense introduced it as evidence.
Yeah, I'm concerned more the damage is done. Well, but there's been a lot of damage here.
Yeah, there's a lot of damaged people. That's what I came away from today, David.
The depth and breadth
I think
of that.
We sometimes forget the reverberations, the deaths that murder and violence like this have on whole families.
It still goes to the defendant, the fact that in that courtroom, there are all these people speaking to him, confronting him with the profound damage he did across such a wide stretch, and he still does not seem to take any reaction, make a reaction to it, or take any acknowledgement of it. So it brings us to the end of day 21 from the Moakley Federal Courthouse. This is Finish Line inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial. And tomorrow, Kevin, I think we'll be expecting the government to rest its case.
Judge O'Toole certainly gave people that impression.
For WBUR, I'm David Boeri.
And I'm Kevin Cullen from the Boston Globe.
Join us again tomorrow.
Finish Line, Inside the Boston Marathon Bombing Trial, is a co-production of WBUR and the Boston Globe. New episodes of the podcast will be released multiple times a week throughout the trial after court lets out for the day. You can listen at WBUR.org and at bostonglobe.com, or you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, where new episodes will appear as soon as they're released. Go to the podcast section of iTunes and search Finish Line to subscribe. Thanks for listening.